Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin student has filed a lawsuit against her college campus after being stopped last February from handing out Valentines she'd written Bible verses on. We'll find out more from a reporter. First, today is the final day of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. For the past week, the hearings have been marked by protests from the public and tense exchanges between the nominee and senators. Daniel Lippman is a reporter at Politico and the co-author of the Politico Playbook. Daniel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what has stood out to you big picture in this week's hearings, Daniel?
I think big picture is that we had a huge surprise earlier this week about how Kavanaugh believes that Roe v. Wade may not be settled law, and so that might make him more likely to, tear down that ruling and vote to restrict abortion rights in a more of a conservative way that he's indicated. And so that was a big shock because of these documents that were pulled apart and released by Cory Booker, who got approval from George W. Bush's lawyer, but was still got lots of Republicans raised hackles because these were secret documents. And Democrats made the point that the public deserves to know what Kavanaugh believes, and more information is for the best for society.
And this issue of documents has been there since the hearings started, right? The question of how much of documents related to Kavanaugh's career, especially when he worked at the White House, should senators see and should the public see?
Yeah, I think, you want to still have some executive privilege, but this was a long time ago. And so, you know, they even joke in some of these emails, you know, these are going to come out in 2021. I hope that they come out very soon. And so they released some of these documents early because of the intense interest in Kavanaugh's nomination and the public interest in learning what his views are because of how he could be such an important swing vote, or not even swing vote, a conservative vote, and that would make John Roberts, the Chief Justice, act as that swing vote, but he would most likely rule in the Republicans' direction most of the time. And so the court is much more partisan than it used to be in past decades.
Behind all of this is the idea that probably we know how this ends as things stand now. Unless something really dramatic happens, there are enough Republican votes to confirm Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court justice, right?
There are. The votes, the numbers are just there, and Republicans are happy that this is happening now instead of, next year, because Democrats definitely have a chance of taking the Senate. That's not guaranteed, but it is like the House seems to be guaranteed for Democrats, but the Senate, every day that all of this crazy Trump White House palace intrigue news stays in the public consciousness, it makes it easier for Democrats to take the Senate and for Republicans not to be able to get judicial nominees through.
Talking to Daniel Lippman from Politico, looking at this week's confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. A lot of big moments from the hearings. Here's one of them. Democratic Senator Kamala Harris had a long exchange with Kavanaugh about the Russia investigation. Here's a listen to some of that.
Have you discussed Mueller or his investigation with anyone at Cassowitz, Benson & Torres, the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, President Trump's personal lawyer? Be sure about your answer, sir.
I'm not remembering, but if you have something you want to...
Are you certain you've not had a conversation with anyone at that law firm?
Cassowitz, Benson.
Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres, which is the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, who is President Trump's personal lawyer. Have you had any conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that firm? Yes or no?
Well, is there a person you're talking about?
I'm asking you a very direct question. Yes or no?
I need to know I'm not sure I know everyone who works at that law firm.
I don't think you need to. I think you need to know who you talked with. Who'd you talk to?
So that led people to wonder, did she know something about exchanges that might be relevant, or was she just kind of fishing? What are people making of this back and forth, Daniel?
It's kind of surprising that he was not prepared for that answer. It seems like it was a curveball to him. They did not come up with that in the questions when they did those murder boards to prepare him. I think people are just wondering if, since Trump doesn't look like he's going to cooperate with a Mueller interview, and then if Mueller subpoenas him, that subpoena might go to the Supreme Court, almost, 100% chance that it would, because Trump would be fighting it. And then that would lead Kavanaugh to have to weigh in on this critical matter affecting the country and whether a sitting president can be subpoenaed. And so that's why the senators are asking these questions about, hey, are you very close to Trump's current or former lawyers? That's an important question to know, because Kavanaugh he's tight in the conservative lawyer circles.
And one more line of attack from Democrats is looking back at Kavanaugh's past testimony before the Senate, and Democrats trying to make the case that he, under oath, had misled the Senate when talking about a past case where some Democratic Senate documents and memos had been leaked to Republicans, whether he knew about them or not. Some emails suggest that he had information from those. He's saying he wasn't aware that they were stolen or obtained in an illicit way. Is that something that is going to haunt him as this process goes forward?
I don't think that that's going to be a huge issue. I think his views about, public issues and women's rights, and a lot of 2020 presidential candidates on the Democratic side, they are using this as a platform to expound and, try to stand up for what their voters and future primary voters want to do. And so that's the situation we find ourselves in. I think what you mentioned is not going to be the top headline. It's more about, this is a very conservative guy who is replacing a moderate and Anthony Kennedy. And even Anthony Kennedy, he's not even a real moderate. He's a conservative. But in today's Republican Party, a person who is a traditional conservative, they're not very recognizable when you have people like Stephen Miller running around in Washington.
Sticking with that idea of this as kind of an opportunity to showcase issues for elections, not even looking at it 2020, but in this year's November midterm elections, do you think that Democrats are going to be able to take stuff out of this hearing, to take issues raised, take concerns about who's on the Supreme Court and rally their base behind that?
I think that's going to be a huge issue, because Democrats who already think, some of them think that Trump is illegitimate because of Russian help in the campaign, I think that they're not going to make the mistake again of ignoring how important the Supreme Court is, and they've benefited from doing well in Supreme Court victories over, decades ago with the liberal court, but that's become sharply conservative, and also state legislatures. They determine how to redistrict, and Republicans have used to great benefit, the power to redraw the lines. And that's why there are more Republicans who represent, people in in Congress. And if you actually look at the vote totals, more Democrats are actually voting. And so, and the Senate is already, with two senators per state, that's already undemocratic. And so a lot of people feel like, President Obama himself today said that we're worried about how America's democracy is on the line in November. So that's why he was urging everyone to get out and vote.
We'll leave it there for now and keep watching the process as it moves ahead. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
Daniel Lipman, reporter at Politico and co-author of the Politico Playbook. He joined us to talk about the week of hearings before senators decide whether or not to confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now, a student at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay filed a lawsuit against the college this week. The incident that led up to the lawsuit involved the student handing out homemade Valentines with written Bible verses. Karen Herzog is a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, start by talking us through what happened back on Valentine's Day this year and the student, Polly Olson.
Polly Olson is a 29-year-old Green Bay woman who is studying to be a paralegal at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College. On Valentine's Day, as she described it, she put on her red dress and went to school to distribute heart-shaped religious valentines made out of construction paper, and they had Bible verses. Among the Bible verses were, "You are special, God is love, Jesus loves you," and she passed them out in the student union. Specifically, where she was stopped was the general studies office, and she was told that that was space that she wasn't invited into, and that she was distributing something that some might find offensive, and she was taken to the security office and told to stop.
And who had done this? A campus security officer, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't clear to me whether someone complained, but they became aware of the fact that she was handing these out. She said she gave them to fellow students and to staffers, and she said everybody wanted one, or at least accepted it and said thank you, except for the security officer who approached her. First, she offered one to the security officer, and he said, "No, I'm here because there's a problem here." And then he took her back to his supervisor, and that's where the conversation took place, where they discussed this public assembly policy that the college has that's restrictive of where you can, and in their terms, distribute literature, petitions, that kind of thing. And so they said that this fell under their public assembly policy and that she would not be allowed to do it under the terms of that policy.
And under that policy, there's a fairly small designated area where people can gather and distribute literature. Is that right?
That's right. It's restricted to an area that's outside the main entrance. And I spoke with her. Actually, it was an email conversation, and Ms. Olson said that this area is about the size of two buses, that it's a very small space. I think she said it constitutes less than 0.5% of the campus, which was part of the this is a free speech case, where it's basically they're saying that she's not allowed to express herself on a campus in which free speech should be guaranteed.
Right. That was back on Valentine's Day of this year. And now this week we have this lawsuit filed by Olson, represented by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Talk more about the lawsuit and what they're arguing.
The lawsuit was filed earlier this week, and it was filed in a federal court. So this is a free speech case. So interestingly, there was another case filed by Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty against Marquette University that also was a free speech case involving a professor, and they won that one. This particular case obviously does not involve a professor, but it's a similar concept of free speech, that if someone wants to distribute something that's conservative in nature, if one would describe a Bible verse, Valentine, as conservative, this particular case involves a young woman who does tend to have conservative beliefs based on some of the other things that I've learned about her. But they're basically saying that the policy is overly broad and that it violates her constitutional rights.
Now, has the college itself spoken up about this case and explained what they were doing here?
The college said that this particular policy has been under review since 2017. In fact, they invited Ms. Olson to participate in the process of rewriting that policy. They came into contact with her in 2014, doing the same thing, distributing these Valentines, and that was shortly after the policy was adopted. So she was aware of the policy, and she also did not seek permission, which was part of the policy, that if you want to do an activity like hand out something that's considered literature, that you have to get advance permission to use this particular space that they have designated, and also that somebody has approved of the activity. So it's basically, the argument is that it's overly restrictive. The college has said, well, we're looking at the policy, and we can't comment specifically on this case because we respect student confidentiality.
And then what remedy are Olson and the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty looking for as they file this lawsuit?
Well, she wants the college to stop applying this policy. to anybody, to other students, anyone. And she also is seeking nominal damages and costs of the attorney fees, which I don't believe there would be any with this particular group. But she also wants to be able to speak spontaneously on issues any time in the future, and not necessarily in the designated public assembly area. She says that other individuals have been allowed to do these kinds of things elsewhere, and that they have not been stopped. So she would just like this policy to go away.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a case in Wisconsin, northeastern Wisconsin, a student at a technical college there filing a lawsuit claiming free speech rights being infringed there when she wasn't allowed to hand out in parts of most of the campus Valentine's Day messages with Bible verses on them. Now, Karen, this is one very specific story, but it's going on against a pretty big backdrop of arguments over free speech on campus. Conservatives saying that conservative speakers are shouted down or not invited. We've heard from liberal professors saying they're subject to online and in-person harassment and threats. Can you put this in a broader framework from what we're seeing at colleges and universities?
This has been happening for the last couple of years on college campuses, and it kind of started, I believe, at the same time that President Trump was elected, when there was so much conversation about in higher education, at least, that conservative viewpoints were being suppressed on college campuses. And there's been a lot more aggressive activity of bringing conservative speakers to campuses and really pushing some of these issues of free speech and any restrictions that might be placed on people who believe their views are being suppressed, which at this point is largely conservative views. You don't hear of liberal speakers complaining about free speech. That hasn't come up in the last couple of years.
And the state legislature has weighed on this, and I think that's mostly been in regard to UW-Madison's campus in particular. I think it's fair to say. Have you seen stories like this in the state's technical college system?
This is the first one I'm aware of in the state's technical college system, and I'm not aware of what policies exist on other campuses. There is an umbrella board for the technical college system, and I have not heard of them weighing in on it, but that doesn't mean that they haven't, and I'm expecting that they probably will decide to do so in the future.
Do you see this when you talk to administrators and other leaders on campus as kind of a headache issue for a lot of people trying to thread the needle and get their policies right?
Well, it's interesting, Rob. What you continually hear when these cases come up is campus administrators saying free speech is exercised every day here. It's very important that we maintain a welcoming and safe environment that promises student success, which is sort of the backdrop of this. If there's also this desire to make campuses welcoming, and if there are individuals who feel that something is being said or done that's offensive, administrators are being very sensitive to that, too. But that, again, comes into conflict with free speech, that one should be allowed to express their views, whether people agree with them or not, or whether they find them offensive, frankly.
Has this gotten, you've been covering higher education for a long time, has this gotten more heated, as you say, in the Donald Trump era, where the partisan lines are drawn a little thicker maybe than they used to be?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about it that everything is so polarized now that I think there's a lot more assertive activity on college campuses, and there's a lot more at stake in trying to establish, in the case of conservatives, that they have as much right to express themselves in classrooms or wherever as anybody else does. I think in the past there was a feeling that they were suppressed, that those views were suppressed, and now that has all changed.
And you mentioned that Marquette University case. We talked to the professor in that case, John McAdams, after he had won. Now, Marquette, a private university. We've been talking about public universities for most of the time. You see these issues coming up not just in state-run campuses.
That's right. In the case of Marquette, it was argued by John McAdams as both a free speech case and also an employment contract, that his right to academic freedom had been violated, that was promised in his employment contract. But commentators around the country have hailed that decision as a victory for free speech, And again, beleaguered conservative professors on progressive campuses. This is something that is going to be an ongoing issue, I think, as long as we have this polarity in politics in the United States.
Now, bringing this back home to this case in Wisconsin at Northeast Technical College and the student Polly Olson, this lawsuit just filed. Do you have an idea of the timeline now that this is being brought to court?
It could take a long time. It depends on whether it's something that is appealed, depending what the decision is. Clearly, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is representing Ms. Olson, has shown a willingness to appeal. In fact, they lost at the Milwaukee County Circuit Court level and Marquette won the first round. And they appealed and bypassed the Court of Appeals, went straight to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And that was the court this past summer that ruled Marquette had breached his contract and ordered that John McAdams be reinstated. And he is back on campus, by the way, this fall. He's not teaching, but he will be teaching again in the spring semester.
We'll leave it there for now, Karen. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Karen Herzog, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the free speech lawsuit filed by a student against Northeast Wisconsin Technical College. The lawsuit comes after a security officer asked the student in question to stop handing out homemade Valentines she'd written Bible verses on Valentine's Day of this year. Want to hear from you now. It's back to school season. Classes have kicked off. If you're a student, a parent of a student, if you work on a campus, are these issues of free speech, liberal and conservative speech, front and center for you? Or are you just getting back to business and taking the classes and getting the job done? Love to hear your experience. Email us, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Food Friday special surfing edition. If you feel like summer's slipping away from you, it is September after all, we can help. What doesn't scream summer like long days on the beach and taking a surfboard into the water? For many, surfing's a way of life, but even if we're not catching a big wave, we can catch a great meal inspired by the world of surfing. When it comes to surf cuisine, our next guest is the expert. He's traveled to 40 countries, surfing his way around most of them, all the while collecting recipes and stories. He shares those in his new book. Jim Kempton's a lifelong surfer, cook, and writer. He's been the editor and publisher of Surfer Magazine. He's currently the president of the California Surf Museum. His new book is called First We Surf, Then We Eat, Recipes for a Lifetime of Surf Travel. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jim, before we start cooking, tell us a little bit about how you got into surfing as a career and as a way of life.
Well, I was—I have an unusual background with that. I was born on Guam, and in the South Pacific, and learned actually the North Pacific, and learned how to surf there, and lived in Southeast Asia in the South Pacific area for the first 13 years of my life, and then moved back to California to start high school. So I learned to surf there, and then of course in California there's lots of surf and surf culture. So I went to high school and college here, and then after I had done a bit of traveling on my own after college and surfing, I got a job at Surfer Magazine as the editor, and eventually became the publisher of the magazine.
And how did that take you into exploring the foods of the surfing world around you?
You know, I think that was just sort of my other passion, if you will. I loved to eat, and I had been exposed to a lot of different cuisines around the world, you know, as a youngster with my parents, and then traveling on my own through Europe and Morocco and Central America and South America during my traveling years. And then at Surfer, I had an enormous opportunity to travel, covering all of the contests and other parts of the culture around the world. And so, you know, eating was the thing you do after surfing. And so my collection of recipes was everything from you know, the backs of napkins and envelopes to beautiful books from the 1800s that had strange recipes of countries like Peru.
And yeah, you've got recipes from all over the world, basically anywhere that touches water, it seems like. And that makes me think, you know, I'm from the Midwest. I look at a globe and I see land masses. And I wonder if your way of life is you see the blue and then where that land hits it. And that is that you see this connected world of water and surfing and food.
You know, it is, and even more. You look where the waves come from. They generate generally from the from the low areas and the high areas. So from the Aleutians up north and from Antarctica in the south. So the Indian Ocean, for instance, is just a straight fetch from where the huge storms begin. So there's a lot of surf through Indonesia and the Mentawais and all the islands in that area. The same with the South Pacific. And Hawaii with waves coming from both the north and the southern tips of the hemisphere.
We are talking about food and surfing. We've got Jim Kempton with us. His new book is First We Surf, Then We Eat. Well, I think if you asked the average American, like, I don't know, me, to name a place that people surf, we would probably say Hawaii first. And that I want to take us into one of your recipes in the book that you've shared with us, the Ono Poke Bowl. And I got to admit, Jim, poke now is all over the place, even here in the Midwest. I still haven't tried it, though. Tell us what poke is.
So poke are chunks of raw tuna that that are marinated in soy sauce and wasabi and mixed together. It's a really delicious. It's like steak tartare, only much tastier, and good tuna belly, which is what they use to make it, is just about as tender and as a filet mignon or more. It melts in your mouth like butter. It has a wonderful taste, wonderful texture, and is super healthy for you. Fish is a high protein item, and if you bring it with a couple of other things, like an we mix it with cut it up with chunks of avocado, and mix it with a dressing like that, and it's a delicious meal, very light, very low calorie, very high in protein, and very nutritious.
We've got that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you write somewhere in the book, I'm looking for it now, that Hawaii is the original fusion cuisine.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. There's a famous food plate there called Plate Lunch, and there were people from all ethnic backgrounds that came to Hawaii over the different periods of time, from the whalers from England and Ireland to the Scots who helped run the plantations when they started them, to the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans who came to work the plantations, to of course the Hawaiians themselves who were the indigenous people there. When the Westerners arrived, and a plate lunch is almost and then you had the Portuguese that came from Madeira during their had a huge sort of potato famine, so to speak, during an era, and they all came to work in Hawaii. And so if you look at a plate lunch, it's got Korean ribs, and it's got Japanese rice, and it's got macaroni for the Portuguese, and it's got chicken for the Chinese, and soy sauce and wasabi for the Japanese, and there's something for everybody in a Hawaiian plate lunch. It sort of traverses the world in one little plate, and that was because everybody would find something they liked on that plate, and it made everyone happy.
Now, if I was going to picture what I thought surfers would make, I would imagine it often involves going back onto the beach and firing up the grill. How important is the grill for your view of surfer cuisine?
Definitely, there's a lot of items that are cooked on the grill in my book. Partly because obviously there are more male surfers than females, and males tend to love barbecue. But also because I tried to set up a book that you could cook on a hibachi or on a charcoal grill or over an open fire with a stick. And if you can get that, then you can cook anywhere, and you don't have to be the greatest cook in the world and make fabulous tasting food.
I want to get into another recipe you've shared with us. We have it at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is smoky corn salsa. Now, before we get into the recipe, it has a painful memory to you, I understand. There's a story attached, a memory attached to your first time you tried this.
Well, I was we were on a surf exploration vessel that that Quicksilver had put together that went around the world for 4 years, and I was the director on it. It was an awful job, as you can imagine. We were in Nicaragua and had gotten out of radio contact with the port, and then we took a little tender boat out to look for surf, and we found this fabulous wave that we had discovered no one had even surfed yet, and we were mesmerized watching it as it broke, and all of a sudden we looked out on the horizon, and there was a gigantic set, a bombora out 200 yards beyond where we were. So we were, we had to try to outrace that swell, and we, you know, it was an 11 wave set, and we made it over the first 10, and the last one looked like it was going to break on us, and we just jammed it over the top, and as we hit the top of the wave and punched through, we went airborne about 10 feet into the air on the backside of the wave, and as you know, boats are not supposed to be in the air. They're made for the ocean. And when we landed, it threw us both I and the captain. There was nothing to hang on to. It was just a little tender boat. And, smashed us into the flooring. And when we got up, I was spurting blood out of my kneecap. And we tied it off and headed home. But we were 2 hours from the boat, which there was really no medical, help there. And then we were going back 3 hours to a port where it was so dirty I wouldn't have lunch there when we left. So in my mind I was thinking, you know, there are times when you put yourself out there and it's not always the safest place to be. Luckily for me, that we tied it off, and once the bleeding was stopped, it was just a deep hole and nothing and no serious damage done, and I was okay. But that night, I had that smoky salsa, and it's definitely burned in my memory.
And it's got a little burn in itself, right? Some chipotle hot sauce, cumin, lime juice, some peppers. It's got a little lot of zest going on there.
You know, and it's funny. I think that one of the things that the whole world is discovering is, you know, people where you are love corn, and I'm sure they have a corn. I mean, I know there's corn salsas now. So adding that little bit of spice and pepper, and you can do it gradually. You'll be amazed at what it adds to dishes that people in regions like the Northwest area and the Midwest do now. It just adds that little bit of zest, that little bit of bite, and it's really a wonderful experience.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about beach-inspired recipes and surfing-inspired recipes. Our guest is Jim Kempton. His new book is First We Surf, Then We Eat, Recipes from a Lifetime of Surf Travel. We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have foods or dishes that remind you of days spent at the beach, things you like to make through the winter to bring a little taste of summer to it? And if you're a surfer yourself, what food do you crave when you get off the water? If you've surfed the oceans of the world, or if you're one of those Sheboygan surfers, if you've surfed anywhere in Lakes Michigan or Superior, I know you're out there. Love to hear your experiences and what foods go with your surfing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our conversation with surfer and cook Jim Kempton. He's the author of the new book, First We Surf, Then We Eat, Recipes from a Lifetime of Surf Travel. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a surfer? If so, what's your go-to meal on the beach, even if you just enjoy beach life? Do you have a favorite tropical type of food? Do you have a question for our guest about surfing and or cooking? And is there a food you like to make in the winter that brings back a little bit of summer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Jim, one of the many regions of the world you've surfed and cooked in is Indonesia. You've got some recipes for Bali. Can you tell us a little bit about the cuisine and how it inspires you?
Well, one of the things that you find out about the spicy food is that originally those were used not only just to enhance the flavor, but also to protect and to preserve the foods, because in the tropics things go off a lot more quickly, and of course there wasn't refrigeration back when these cuisines were being developed. So the Balinese food is spicy. It's not super hot pepper spice the way some, you know, with like Thai food or with Hunan or some Mexican peppers, but it's very spicy in terms of having a variety of spices. And of course, those islands were very close to what they called the Spice Islands, and were actually part of the Spice Islands once they were being discovered and developed by the Europeans. And so the food there tends to be tends to have a lot of sauces. Tends to be very quickly stir fried, and have a lot of spices as well.
And now, tell us a little bit about the surfing in that part of the world.
Well, one of the interesting things about Indonesia is that it's got more coastline because of the hundreds and hundreds of islands. It's actually 1,700 islands in that archipelago. So they've got more coastline than the coast of the United States and Canada put together. So there's an enormous number of opportunities there. And as I was saying earlier, you've got the Indian Ocean that just pumps these huge swells that come for thousands of miles across the Indian Ocean and into Indonesia, and they break on reefs, which means that it's a much more abrupt hit that the wave gets, which means that its power has not been diminished by dragging on a continental shelf, and so the power of it, just like in Hawaii, tends to be much greater, and the waves tend to be hollower, and that's what surfers love once they become competent or expert at what they do. They're looking for that challenge, and there's almost constant waves in that region of the world.
Now, as a very much lifelong landlubber, that sounds kind of scary to me, looking out from that beach and seeing this power that's literally built up over, what, thousands of miles coming at me and just standing there on a big piece of fiberglass, I guess.
You know, it's just like pole vaulting. You know,
you do it by
inches. You know, you just raise the bar a little bit over and over again. In fact, I once asked a big wave rider how he learned to surf 40-foot waves, and his answer was by learning how to surf 15-foot waves, and then 16-foot waves, and then 17-foot waves. And it's very much that way. A lifetime of surfing. You know, if you can dedicate a year or two to surfing all the time, you get very comfortable with that.
I want to bring on a caller now. Matt is with us in Bailey's Harbor. Matt, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a Great Lakes surfer. I first started surfing out in Hawaii. I lived out there for 3 winters, but one of the foods I really fell in love with was the musubi.
Yes. That's very Hawaiian.
Yeah. So, Matt, before I let you go, how does the surfing here stack up against Hawaii?
Well, you know, when the days are good, they aren't very crowded, which is really nice up here in Door County. But, you know, there are some fun days out here I've had. So I really do like it, although I do miss the waves in Hawaii.
All right. Thanks a lot, Matt. So what is musubi, Jim?
It's a Hawaiian dish that is rice and meat and wrapped in a seaweed that very tightly, and it's sort of like you would call it a seaweed bun sandwich, really delicious.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jim Kempton, surfer and cook, about his new book, First We Surf, Then We Eat. Well, Wisconsin is pretty far off the beaten path when it comes to surfing. Jim, what are some of the places around the world that you've enjoyed surfing in that people might not think of as surfing places?
So one of them is an area called the Basque Country, which is the Atlantic coastline of France and Spain. And the Basques are the people who have lived there longer than anyone else in Europe. They're Europe's oldest people. And it's a fabulous area, very, very high quality of living, and lots of surf from the Atlantic. It also has a kind of unusual thing in that the Gulf Stream, which leaves and sweeps out into the Atlantic, curves back down, hits the very southern westmost tip of England, and then comes into the Bay of Biscay right there. So there's probably 7 or 8 months out of the year when the water is relatively warm compared to what the water is like in the rest of the coastlines of the Atlantic, like Portugal or other parts of France. And So it's kind of an ideal place that has a lot of surf, and has incredible food. As you know, the French and France and Spain are known for, at least in modern times, their great food, and then the Basque put this sort of extra touch on it of their own, and they were one of the first people to take the peppers from the New World and make use of them.
Yeah, what are some of the foods that you've really enjoyed from Basque country?
So there's they call it piperard there, and they use onions and peppers and tomatoes for almost a large number of their dishes. But one is called poulet basquez, and it's a tomato sauce with peppers and onions cooked with chicken, and you barbecue the chicken first and then put it into a pot, and you stir fry the onions and bell peppers, and then let them all kind of marinate together in one pot, and then serve it over rice. And I've never had anybody who didn't eat more than one helping.
I'm looking at a picture of a Basque omelet that just looks beautiful here.
So that's a perfect example of using the sort of the same ingredients to a different thing. That's what they do for breakfast. And if you like that, if you can just imagine that with chicken and rice instead of the eggs, that's what you'd be looking at with poulet basquez.
Now, one common theme I see here, Jim, is a lot of this stuff looks delicious, but it looks pretty healthy too.
Well, I did make an effort to do that. You know, over the years, we've learned so much about nutrition and healthy eating and what helps your body and what hurts your body. And so I tried to alter the recipes just enough to maybe put a little superfood into it, or to remove some of, you know, to cook with maybe a healthier oil or whatever that might be. And I also tried to pick the healthiest of the recipes from places, no matter where they were in the world.
Now, you're with the California Surf Museum. Can you leave us with maybe your favorite California surfing site and a favorite California-style cuisine?
Well, my favorite surfing spot in California is probably Lower Trestles, which is very near where I live, just a few miles from where I live, and is my kind of my home break. And it's a beautiful wave. Has gotten very crowded, so I surf the breaks around it now as much as I surf it, but it's a fabulous wave. And for California cuisine, you know, the funny thing about California cuisine is that it is so integrated with the food of Mexico that some of my favorite things are sort of what we call California fusion food, which after Hawaii is probably the biggest fusion place there is. It's a quesadilla that's in the book that we had at the restaurant I owned, that we sort of made up for ourselves, and it was the most popular thing on the menu.
What's on that quesadilla? I glanced at it, but I can't remember what was in the recipe.
So it's chorizo and mushrooms and cheese, and then topped with sour cream and tomatoes.
Pretty straightforward, but it sounds really good.
Oh, man, you have to taste, you have to try it to believe it.
And, Jim, briefly, before I let you go, I got to ask, we played a little surf-style music to start things off. Do surfers really listen to surf music?
Well, I mean, yeah, yes and no. I mean, you know, it's actually kind of come back now because of some of the great directors that have been using it in some of the coolest movies recently. So yes, a little bit, but you know, surfers generally listen to the same sort of music that everybody does. You know, there was a period in time when that was true, just like there was a period in time when people all rode longboards. But you know, everything moves on, they listen to a variety of music.
Thanks a lot to Jim Kempton. We've been talking about his new book, First We Surf, Then We Eat, Recipes from a Lifetime of Surf Travel. If you're feeling hungry, we've got a couple of Jim's recipes, smoky corn salsa and Ono Poke. You can find those at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's a story in the news about a hidden treasure found in a medieval castle in a legendary secret corridor. All right, that's got a lot of appeal to a nerd like me, but keep going, it gets better, again, from my nerdly perspective. That treasure isn't a lost crown or a chest full of gold. It's a board game. Russian researchers located a secret room this summer at Vyborg Castle, located on a bay near their border with Finland. This is real estate that's changed hands a lot over the centuries. The Swedish-built castle goes back to the 1200s. There have been legends of this secret corridor since the 1600s, and Russian researchers found it and explored it this summer. One of the things they found, a baked clay tablet with a game board etched into it. The game looks a lot like Nine Men's Morris. That's a game dating back to the Roman Empire, played into the modern era. It's also known now as the mill game or cowboy checkers. I guess cowboys used to carve this onto the back of checkerboards for a different game. The rules, basically, you need to line up your dudes to take away the other player's dudes. The find shows that even centuries ago, one of the best ways to deal with a long, cold, boring night, maybe on guard duty at the castle, I don't know, was to pull out a board game. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.